Financial Residency is proud to bring you Grand Rounds with Dr. Tammy. Each week, Tammy Krause explores a new topic related to achieving financial independence by building and protecting your wealth. She invites guests who are experts in their fields who will share honest and valuable advice on a variety of topics. If you have an idea for a podcast, please email Tammy, that's T-A-M-M-Y, at financialresidency.com. Now grab your front row seat to this week's Grand Rounds.
Hi, and welcome back to Grand Rounds. I am so excited to have Dr. Rebecca Bernard back with us today. She's been with us before to talk about the direct primary care movement. And many of you maybe have come across her at conferences, as she also does a lot of work with preventing scope creep, starting to help roll back the corporatization of medicine, and also works with physician wellness. And she's here today to talk to us about the latter and maybe put a little bit of control back in our hands. And she's offering more than a pizza party. So welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to see you.
I am so excited. I know you speak frequently on this topic, so I'm excited to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really know too much about this whole idea of burnout or moral injury or wellness or any of this stuff until maybe 8 or 9 years ago when we lost a physician in our community to suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was so shocking because this was a doctor that seemed to have everything going for him. He was always positive and upbeat and just, you know, just a super guy. And when I found out that he had taken his life, I was just really devastated, and so were all the doctors in our community. And coincidentally, around the same time, we also had a suicide of a physician in the county north of us. So both of our counties were dealing with this, and I was on the board, just a board member of our medical society. And so we were talking about what we could do, and we decided, well, let's try to create some type of physician wellness program. And so as part of that, since I was on the board, they asked me, well, maybe you could do some research and, you know, come back and give a presentation about the topic. So I think this was just in the very beginning when we were really having these conversations starting to happen about this issue. So I started doing some research. I started talking with a friend of mine who's a psychologist in our community and just learning a lot about some of the ways that we could cope with the stressors that we have. And so actually we ended up co-writing a book together about different things that physicians could do to help manage and prevent burnout and stress and hopefully decrease the risk of getting to that point of hopelessness. And of course, like you said, I love that it's better than a pizza party, because I think that this is the idea from so many of like administrators and managers. Well, you know, let's just, you know, we'll work them to death, but then we'll throw them a pizza and then that's going to make it all better. And of course, we know that's not the case. And neither are, you know, mandatory wellness lectures or things like that. It really is about figuring out a way to give physicians autonomy again.
Sometimes I feel like some administrations are just a death by a thousand cuts. So many of the things they ask us to do don't improve patient care whatsoever, but they do make the physician work, you know, an extra 2, 3, 4 hours at night to meet these metrics that don't improve patient care at the end of the day. So what can we do to take back some control?
Yeah, you know, I think about being a young doctor early in my career, and I came out of residency in 2002, and we didn't have really metrics. I mean, we probably had some, but this was pre-mandatory electronic health records mm-hmm. and pre all this data collection that doctors, you know, physician computerized and order entry. I remember a time, and I don't think all of my colleagues do, those that came out of residency, say around 2010 or after, all this really started. I remember it really getting going 2006 or seven. I was in a federally qualified health center. So we were sort of early adopters because of federal funding that we had to start bringing in these electronic systems. And I remember them coming out and immediately saying to the administration, this is not going to make my life easier. It's actually going to make my life so much worse. And the response was, well, too bad. This is what we're going to do. And I even remember like one time I was complaining that the screen was so small that I couldn't read the print. And the manager said, well, maybe you just need to get glasses. I mean, that was the kind of response. And this was, I was coming from a point where I did in my residency on computers, but at my first job, we actually used paper. And, there's some negative things about using paper, but let me tell you from a perspective of a quick note and just, I don't know, did you ever use those T sheets in the ER? Where you would just have like a checklist and you would pick the sheet that was applicable to the problem and just check, 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 and your note was done. Well, of course, those days were gone. And now you just had to, click on the computer and, screen after screen after screen. And of course, these systems that were totally designed not for us or by us, but we had to learn how to deal with them and create all these workarounds. So, I mean, I think.
I was just going to say, I remember back in residency, we used paper and it really helped me format my thoughts. And I hated it when we went to the EMR because it was no longer my flow, but I was having to make this EMR, work. And it didn't matter what helped me. It was just all about the EMR, really.
Yeah, for example, is in medical school, you're trained to write a SOAP note, and that's how your brain, subjective, objective, et cetera. And I remember our system had it kind of like reverse, like the first thing that would pop up was were the vital signs, and that so that was out of order. And I remember saying to them, to the, the computer people, like, but this isn't how doctors think. This isn't how we're trained. And they just kind of shrugged at me and like they just didn't care. And so it was really eye-opening. And the other thing that I remember, it must have been, I don't know, around 2009 or 10. And I was at the Florida Academy, or sorry, the American Academy of Family Physicians had a congressional conference in DC. And they had a panel. Then we were asking questions. And one of the people on the panel was President Obama at the time. It was one of his chiefs regarding electronic health records. And I remember a physician from Tennessee got up at the microphone and he said, I want to express a concern that I have, and it's very hard for physicians to work with these systems. We're really feeling quite burdened with them, and we're wondering what the administration will do about it. And she looked at him and she said, well, we don't think it's a problem. And that was the end. And I remember he was kind of just stood there and said, okay, thank you, and then sat down. And I remember it so vividly because I tweeted about it. I said, this is what we're you have a physician telling you this is a problem, and your response is, we don't think it's a problem.
Yeah,
And
we
I think
don't
this is
care.
the so when it comes to autonomy, I just think so many times doctors say, like, oh, it's too late, there's nothing we can do. And I think part of it is we always act like that. I remember them telling me, okay, this is the system, you're going to have to use it. And I said, okay. I mean, I complained about it. I tried in my little, pathetic way to make things a little bit better, which wasn't successful because, you can't change these big systems. But ultimately, me and every other physician just said, okay. And we just went along with it. And now here we are, where physicians want to leave medicine, where we're burned out, where doctors are leaving medicine, where doctors are taking their own lives. I mean, it's a terrible situation. And if you go back, you say, what if we just had said as a group, no, this isn't something that we can do. And I know that's kind of a, to say something like that is like easier said than done. But I think we're getting to that point where physicians are starting to come together, are starting to push back. Unionization, things like that. I know for me, my response has been at a certain point to say, I'm not going to work within a system that where I don't know the rules, or the rules are changing, or basically the game is fixed so that I can never win no matter what I do. So that's why I do direct primary care. But I also realize that not everybody can do that. Some of us rely on hospitals and organizations for the type of specialty we have, for the infrastructure. Or you're in a situation where you have to have an employer for whatever reason. You have kids in school, or there are things. So that was one of the reasons that I co-wrote the book Physician Wellness, to try to give some tips and some advice for those of us that really have to stay and work within the system, or want to try to work within the system to make it better. Of course, ultimately, I think if there's a way to get out of the system and truly take back your autonomy working in some type of a free market or cash system, then of course that's always what I'm going to recommend. But I know that we need another way if you have to work within the system.
So people who are within that system, Is it just the little tiny things that can make a difference, or are there bigger things that we can take control of again?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've spent a lot of time studying and learning about is the practice of mindfulness. And it took me a long time to kind of get this idea because I'm not really one of those like touchy-feely, new agey type people. I like more practical, pragmatic things. So when you hear mindfulness, it just kind of sounds like mystical, but it's really not. And the idea is just learning how to be focused and present in the moment. And by learning that, it makes you so much more tolerant when you're actually sitting in that exam room or when, you're facing all these challenges. I know for me in my first job dealing with this, my blood pressure used to go so high. I actually ended up on medication at like 28 years old because I was just so like stressed and so overwhelmed with everything. So when you can't control a situation and you feel trapped, I guess, one of the best things that you can do is to basically take it back, take it into what you can control, which is the only one thing, and that's how you choose to think about a situation. And thinking about it like, I'm just going to get through this moment. I'm going to focus on what I can control. Maybe at this moment, it's just my breathing. Maybe it's at this moment, just listening and focusing on the patient that's in front of me. And one of the things that I learned is the way to develop mindfulness is to practice. And you can do that through something formal, like a daily meditation. And I will tell you, Tammy, when I do my daily meditation, I have a better day. However, like everybody, I just never do it. I know I should do it. I feel better when I do it. But yet, here I am admitting to you that it's been weeks since I've actually done it. But when I do sit down, and I usually use Insight Timer, but there's lots of apps, free apps. When I sit in the morning, when I get to work, and I turn off the lights and I put the timer on, and I just for 10 minutes focus on my breathing, I have a better day. So that's one thing that you can do. And I'm saying this out loud to remind myself to start doing it again, because it does help. But it also doesn't have to be that formal. It could also be just taking a moment just to take like two or three deep breaths. Or it could be, when you stop at a traffic light, just instead of letting your mind think about all these things, taking a moment to look at the color of the light. So it sounds kind of silly, but just taking a second to direct your attention and your focus on what you feel, what you see, what you hear, instead of all the million thoughts that are going on in your mind, that's really helpful and can help you feel a little bit better in the moment, especially when you're facing frustrations. So that's one of the tips. And then the other thing that I've learned is for my own practice, and I have a little bit of control now. I have all the control because I'm a direct primary care doctor. However, I still have 100% control because the patients I have to, make sure that they're taken care of. So that means that sometimes I'm working more hours than I might necessarily want to, or I'm trying to accommodate to them. And one of the things that I learned is about this principle called Parkinson's principle. And it's this idea that work expands to fill whatever time you give to it. So what I've decided to do is instead of like stretching out my workday for 8 hours, I ask myself, can I actually contract my work hours and actually get everything done in a shorter time period? And what that means, though, is during that time period, I have to be really focused on what I'm doing. That's where that practice of mindfulness kind of comes in. But one of the ways that I do that is I try to eliminate distractions. And we live in this world now where it's like ding, ding. I'm talking to people and their watch is dinging. It's funny, my husband's watch dinged the other day. And I said, "Oh, did you get a message?" And he said, "Oh, no, it just told me to breathe." I'm like, I think he was driving. I think it said to also like get up and go for a walk. I'm like, okay, great. So, we're getting all these notifications. My patients can text and email me. So sometimes I see my phone flashing and, right away I'm like, oh, what do they want? And then I look and it's like somebody saying, thank you. And so I'm like, oh, I'm getting aggravated for no reason. So the way that I have decided to deal with that is I turned off all the notifications on my phone, on my computer. I banned myself from looking at Facebook on my computer at work. So I tried to insulate myself from all these distractions. I also only let myself check my tasks, which my office manager sends me tasks throughout the day as patients are calling to, tell me things or things that need to be done, medication refills and so on. Instead of just checking it throughout the day like a million times like I used to do, I schedule myself so I only check it at certain times of the day. Like maybe I'll check it at 11 and I check it again at 4. So that is one of the ways that you can really, by scheduling your time and kind of compressing, but being really focused and mindful on what you're doing, you can accomplish a lot more in a shorter period of time.
Now, how do you control for some of the external forces that are going to try to suck away your time? I don't know, a patient who maybe you have a 5-minute appointment or 15-minute appointment scheduled and they want to take 30 minutes, or an office manager who just absolutely wants your attention right now. Can you control those types of things too to make
Yeah,
this work?
I don't think we can always control everything. And certainly in medicine, we know we can't. You have a 5-minute check-in appointment with a patient and you find out that they just got diagnosed with cancer or, something like that, or there's a crisis in the clinic and your office manager needs you immediately. Definitely, there's going to be times that you're not going to be able to control that and you just kind of have to roll with it and be flexible and adapt yourself. But if you're able to control your schedule most of the time, then I think you'll be a little more tolerant when you do have those sort of crisis situations, which are inevitable. It's always nice. It'd be so nice if we could schedule some buffers into our day, but it just, even if you did, you can't predict when those things are going to come up. But one of the tips that I learned from my friend who's a psychologist, which I thought was the most brilliant thing that never occurred to me, he said, why do you think it is when patients come in to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist and they always know that it's time to end? Like things always wrap up on time. Now, these are patients with mental illness or patients with serious psychological concerns. And we know, of course, as in our practice, a lot of times those patients are very draining because they have a lot to talk about. But yet, when they see the psychiatrist or the psychologist, they know, oh, our hour is up. And he said it's because they are told and they know how much time they have in the visit. Whereas patients of a primary care office or regular practice, now obviously this doesn't work for the ER setting, but for those of us with office practices, patients almost never know how much time they have. They just know they have an 11:15 appointment, but they don't know if that's scheduled for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. I mean, how would they know? Because
True.
nobody really tells them. So he said to me, the simplest thing that we could do that would make such a difference is just tell your patients how much time you have for the appointment. And it's so weird because I remember thinking like, oh, that would be so awkward and weird. And he said, and further, if the patient is talking a lot and you're starting to see that you're getting to the end of the visit and you're not progressing where you need to be, then you can give them a notice of that. You can say, you know what? We have 5 minutes left of our appointment, so really we need to, focus on what's the most important to you right now. And so giving them a 5-minute reminder. And then he said, and then when the visit is up, just like a psychologist would do, to say, oh, I'm really sorry, we're out of time. We're going to have to schedule our next visit. And I was like, wow, that is amazing. So I started trying it, and I didn't start it right away with everybody, but I had a patient who was just a very talkative and friendly person. So I tried it. Even after we got started, I said, oh, I just want to let you know that we have 30 minutes scheduled for our visit today. And he was like, oh, we do? Oh, okay. And he got focused right away. And I was really surprised because he wasn't offended or angry or upset. He actually took it really well. And then, we got through our visit and it was like the best visit I ever had with him because we were focused and we got through it. And then the next time when he came in, he said, how much time do we have? 30 minutes, right? And I said, yes. And he's like, okay. And he got right to the point. And I was so shocked at how well that worked. And also giving that 5-minute timer, reminder. Patients, in my experience, really like it. They value it. It wasn't the response that I expected at all. And it has made such a big difference to keeping me on track and on time.
Can you include your office staff in that too? Like maybe when you're scheduling the appointment, they say, hey, I'm going to put you in for a 15-minute appointment. Or when your nurse is rooming the patient, say, okay, you've got 15 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. And I think that for the schedulers, for sure. And then for the nurses, I think one thing that the psychologist told me was like to keep it really positive. So instead of making it seem like you've only got 15 minutes, to be more like, so we've got 15 minutes and I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. So I guess the only caveat would be like just to keep it like super positive. And I mean, I think for the scheduler, it's just telling the patient it's 15 minutes. That sets it in their mind. And then just letting them know in the beginning, just to set the tone. I don't even do it all the time now with my patients because they know they've figured it out. Just like I don't think psychiatrists tell people every time. People just know, oh, I have a 45-minute visit. And then there's always a, my friend said, you notice how every psychiatrist or psychologist office has a big clock on the wall? He's like, it's not just there for decoration. It's there to keep people on track. It keeps me on track. It keeps them on track. And a lot of people don't have a good sense of time. And that includes us as clinicians. We don't always realize how time is passing. So sometimes we need to keep an eye on that clock just to make sure that we're staying on track and our patients also can see and know how much time has passed.
That is such a simple thing. That is one of the things that I really hated about clinic going back to residency. I would end up 3 hours behind almost every day that I was in clinic. And so I was still there 8, 9 o'clock at night trying to get my notes done because I was so bad at trying to cut off people when I felt like they needed to talk. So
It
this is
is
so
so,
simple.
it is hard because you do have that people pleasing, and you know people are just so desperate for your time and your attention. So I think, you know, kindness and empathy and those really good listening skills, you know, people often feel like they had a lot longer with you if they really feel like they were heard. And that's the other thing that I learned from psychology is you don't always have to do for people or act, but patients really just need to feel that they've been heard and they've been understood. And so that means when they start talking, try not to interrupt them, even when you know you kind of like immediately, like someone opens their mouth. I mean, this just happened to me a few days ago. A lady came in and her entire arm was swollen and she had, you know, very large lymph nodes in her neck. And I just touched them when she came in because she was showing it to me. And I knew immediately that this was very serious and that it was most likely cancer. But right away, she started talking to me and she started telling me how she had gone on YouTube and she was reading about this lymphedema therapy and she wanted to go to see a physical therapist and try some massage techniques. And she was talking about this. And I think in my younger days, when I was newer, I might have just kind of stopped her and just said, listen, this is not going to work. You, this, we need to get a biopsy. And but now that I have this a little bit more experience and understanding, I just let her talk. And she probably spent, of course, it seems like forever because you're like, I know what we need to do. Let's get going. But it was probably a minute, 2 minutes. And she told me all this. And then she said, but it's probably something bad. So she knew, but she kind of had to get to that point. And then I said, yes, I am concerned that it is probably something serious and we need to do, you know, here's what we should do, XYZ. And, you know, we created a plan together, but we, by letting her get to that point where she was ready to be open and receptive, I think that just saves you so much time in the end, because patients actually are ready to hear what you have to say. So listening and doing that, what they call emotional mirroring, where someone says to you something and you kind of repeat it back to them, that's such a good way for patients to feel heard. And then it helps you to move into your actual agenda. And the patient is in a receptive frame of mind. And that way, you don't have to spend as long, you know, kind of getting, building that relationship where you're agreeing on a plan. So that's something that I wish I had known back in those early days of clinic as well, as far as just, you know, even if you let them talk for a minute or two without interrupting, it actually may save you time and actually get the visit done more quickly than if you had jumped in right in the beginning.
I agree. I've also heard you talk about motivational interviewing. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, you know, this is something that we all struggle with. And I'd say right now I'm going personally through a struggle where I just have, a, like we all do, a lot of patients that are challenged with health issues that they come to you asking for help with. But a lot of their issues have to do with some of the choices that they make. You know, maybe they're having a cough and short of breath, but they're smoking a couple of packs of cigarettes a day. Just as an example, we all have those patients.
Sure.
Or patients that come and need help with their diabetes management, but you know, they like to eat a lot of fast food. And you know, there's we all have that. And I'm always quick to remind myself that I have my own struggles and vices, and we all do. So how do you get someone to move towards change? You know, they're there, so that means that they're sometimes I ask myself why patients keep coming back if they don't do anything that I say. And then my psychologist friend reminds me, well, they're showing up, so they're getting something out of it. So that first and foremost, I think reminding ourselves that, you know, even though your patients don't seem like they're doing the things that you want them to do, the fact that they're showing up and they're following up means that they're making an effort and they are getting something out of it. And hopefully with time, they'll start moving more in the direction of improving their health. So motivational interviewing is a way of helping patients to think about their behaviors, think about why they're doing the things that they're doing, and how their life might be different or better if they made different choices. And the idea is to help them come up with their own intrinsic motivations for change. And I'll give you an example that was really blew my mind. One of my patients, she had a pretty heavy drinking problem and a lot of health consequences from her drinking. And so I did all the usual things. You know, I lectured her about alcohol. It's not good for you. I suggested medication to help her quit drinking, you know, all the things that we do. And I had learned about motivational interviewing and I said, I'm just going to try this and see if it works. So one of the things they teach you how to do is just to ask the patient, you know, what do you think would be better in your life if you changed whatever habit? So I asked her, what would be better if you cut back or quit drinking? And she kind of paused for a minute and she said, well, my husband would quit nagging me so much. And I remember, like, I looked at her and I saw her, like, it's like the wheel started turning. It was the funniest thing. And she goes, yeah. My husband would probably stop nagging me so much. That would be so great. And like I could see her actually like thinking like this is a reason for her to actually want to quit drinking. You know, she the you know your liver damage and all these things that I'm telling her, those things weren't really bothering her. Like, I don't care about that. But my husband nagging me, now that's something that would be a positive in my life. So then they teach you in motivational interviewing then to go on, you know, you reinforce these positive thoughts that people are expressing, and then you try to help them create a plan. So you can say, so if you did want to cut back on drinking, what would be your first step? And she said, well, I guess instead of drinking vodka for breakfast, I could drink tea. I remember I kind of like, don't react, don't think it's vodka for breakfast. But I said, yeah, what that's a great idea. So instead of drinking vodka, you'll drink tea for breakfast. And she said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. That's my first step. And it actually, like, so all this lecturing and all this, you know, harassing that I was doing, you know, your liver and none of that made a difference. But her coming up with her own idea and reason why it would be good for her, and then coming up with her, like, I wouldn't have thought to say, well, why don't you quit drinking vodka? I might have said, well, why don't I, you know, we want to try some naltrexone or whatever, or AA. But she came up with her own plan, and you're always going to be more successful when you want to do something for yourself, for your own reasons, and you come up with a strategy that works for you. And so that's the theory behind motivational interviewing. There's a lot of resources online about it. I only know a little tiny bit about it, but it's such a powerful concept that I really think everybody should, you know, take a little bit of time to learn more about it, read about it. There's some really cool videos online about motivational interviewing that can be really helpful for all physicians.
It sounds like you're putting your patient back in control. You're not lecturing to them. They are taking control of it. And maybe that actually takes some of the burden off you as a practitioner as well, or the physician, to where you're not feeling responsible for her not quitting drinking.
Yeah, and I think that's so important because the other thing that I've learned, and it's a big struggle, is like I'm not that important in the scheme, in the big scheme of things. You know, it's kind of unfair because I'd say society and the government and insurance companies, it feels like they want to put the responsibility of patient outcomes on the doctors, as if we somehow in that 15-minute visit a couple times a year have this power and this influence that we can get patients to transform their lives. Now, it's not to say that we can't make an impact or we don't make a difference. And we do. I mean, I've met patients that said, I said, oh, you quit smoking. That's great. Why? Well, because you told me to. And, you know, you almost fall on the floor because you can't believe it. But it does happen. And many patients do take what we say very seriously, and we can make a difference. But on the other hand, we're not, you know, the ultimate responsibility. We are not God. We are not that patient. We are just there to give advice and be supportive and help. And that means that the patient is the one that has to do the work. And that's one of the things that I've had to learn is that I can't work harder and you can't work harder than the patient. The person that cares or should care the most about their own health is the person, is the patient. So if I'm harassing and haranguing a person to get their colonoscopy or colon cancer screening or whatever it is, and I'm ruminating about how to help them pay for this test or that test, and they're kind of not really doing anything about it, then that's a problem. That's a disconnect. So we have to help the patients come up with their motivations for change. Our job, I always say, my job is to give you all of the information, to give you the risks and the benefits and the alternatives. And your job is to decide what you want to do. And then I also have to learn how to be okay with the patient's decisions. And that's really hard, right? Because sometimes you see patients doing self-destructive behaviors, or, and especially if I'm getting a grade from an insurance company, like now I'm getting an F because, you know, my patients have, you know, really high A1Cs and they're smoking and they didn't get their mammogram. And that's, I think, part of this moral injury or disconnect that we have in the healthcare system. Is we have to allow patients to have autonomy, and how can we therefore grade doctors on whether the patients are doing the things that, you know, we've asked them or want them to do. So ultimately, it is their life, it is their decision. And that's kind of something I think as a society and as a healthcare system, we really have to reconcile, you know, how we're going to go forward with balancing patient autonomy with the high costs of healthcare and just general medical treatments overall.
I don't work in the clinic, so I'm not personally graded on metrics like that. But I think for my own mental health, when I realize I'm here to give advice, I'm their cheerleader, I am not responsible for whatever decision they decide to make or not make, I think that helped me so much, you know, overcome some of the burnout I was feeling, or just this dread that I maybe wasn't making as much of a difference as I wanted to. But that is huge to realize that we don't control anyone else except ourselves.
Yeah. And it's hard. You know, I still struggle with it a lot. That patient that I told you about with the probable cancer, I hadn't seen her in a while. Right away, I thought, what if I had seen her more frequently? And I, of course, my instinct is to go into her chart and what did I miss? What did I do wrong? And I think that's sort of a normal reaction and an emotion that a lot of doctors face. And so I think that's also why I'm a big fan of doctors having their own therapist or psychologist, because we have these automatic thoughts and we judge ourselves a lot of times very harshly. And the truth is, we are going to have bad outcomes and we are going to make mistakes, as horrible and painful as that is. That's the reality. We're human beings. And I promise you, we've all made mistakes and you feel terrible about it. And in fact, that was, I think, one of the contributing factors to a physician suicide that we had in our community, where there was a bad outcome. And I think that that doctor really, I think that was a factor, just being able to live with having made a mistake. And that's just so sad, because you think about all the people now that won't be helped by that person, and all the people that he helped before. So I think we need to remember we're human and we need to get support. We need to talk to our peers and our colleagues, and it's perfectly fine. And I kind of think it almost should be mandatory that we all have a therapist or psychologist, because being a doctor is really hard. It's a lot of responsibility. I was just thinking, as a family doctor, of how many patients that I really got to know for many years and cared about deeply have died over the years just of age or, you know, natural causes. I can't think of too many professions where in your career you lose hundreds and maybe even thousands of people that almost, in some ways become your friends or even family members. And I think that's heavy and that weighs on us. So we need a lot of support. There's no shame in getting help. And even if it's not for just dealing with your own emotional stuff, learning how to help other patients through their emotional issues. I've learned so much from working with psychology that has helped me be a better doctor to my patients. So I guess I would just encourage everyone not to be afraid to have a few sessions here or there, have a relationship with a therapist, because there are a lot of things that can make your life better in the office and outside of the office.
I think you're right. I don't know that this is anything that you were trying to say was super important, but one concept that you've said the word a few times tonight and it really struck home with me is tolerance. And I think I've learned over the years that the more tolerant I'm feeling, whether it be towards my coworkers or my patients or even my family, is kind of an indicator as to where my mental health is on any given day. When I was going through burnout a year and a half ago or so, I was not tolerant of patient families. I was so tired of people coming in and saying, "I read this on Google, or whatever," and I had zero tolerance. And it wasn't until I think I got myself into a healthier position that I could understand or I could accept that again and maybe talk them through whatever it was that they read on the internet.
I think it's compassion fatigue, Tammy. I think about my first job at a community health, a federally qualified health center, and I was absolutely right there. I had gotten to the point where I was so burned out, I did not care. I mean, I had this terrible situation where one of my patients was actually murdered by her husband, and I cared for her and her parents and her children as their family doctor, and it was a small community. So after that happened, of course, they were all in my office and the grief and the crying. And then I remember, like, after dealing with that, a patient came in and she was telling me how her son had robbed her because he had a drug problem. And I was like, Like, I did not, I was like, yeah, did your mom get killed by her husband? No, okay. Like, I didn't have anything left. And I think, it didn't have to be that like acute of an issue, but just like you said, death by a thousand cuts. If you're depleted and you have nothing left to give, you can't show and have the empathy that you normally would have. So I think learning to recognize that, I think that might also be when we start getting to where, not that we'll necessarily make mistakes, but we're not giving our best. And also, patients can feel that you're not with them. And so we need to, at that point, say, I need to take a break. I need to maybe take a vacation, take a sabbatical, cut my hours, work with therapists, do whatever I need to do to replenish myself, because keep going like this is just a recipe for disaster for you and for others.
I think you're right. The other thing that came to mind is I'm a hospitalist, as you know, and there's always this battle. And I feel like it's even a bigger battle when you're first out of residency and you're an early career physician. The ER wants to admit whatever, social admit. And as a hospitalist, you're like, absolutely not. There's no medical reason, and I'm not going to do it. And I've been watching this with some of my newer colleagues who have come on in the last few months. And it made me realize that as I've gotten older, there are things I can't control. Also, having taken so many of those social admits over the years, I've realized how much of a difference we can make for someone who just needs a night away from the house or, a family member who can't take care of that husband with Alzheimer's tonight. And it's some of the little things that we can do, both as humans. I don't know. I think we have to realize the stressors that we're under, the stressors that our colleagues are under. And sometimes you just do things and sometimes they're out of your control and you just accept it. But I think as a later career physician, I've just realized that sometimes I just do things because it's out of my control or I'm just helping someone and it's not a battle I need to fight today.
I think it's that change over in your brain from young, idealistic, I don't want to say naive, but I know I was. And this idea of, well, this is what I was taught and I'm following the rules and the medical indications. And then with a little life experience and, I guess life slaps you in the face and things like that. And you start to see and understand a little bit more that, things aren't always black and white.
Yes.
And I think also, though, if you're really burned out and this is your, X number of admission per night, that social admit might just be what pushes you over the edge. So I
True.
think it's easier to have that. And we want to have that ability to tolerate, have the tolerance and the empathy. And I think that's where doctors have to push back a little bit, or maybe a lot, about what our limits are, what our boundaries are. I can only do X amount before I get to that point where I can't anymore. And it's okay to say, this is my limit. I remember in my training days, it was a real badge of honor if you showed up with a fever and, put yourself on an IV in the call room. And, well, I remember I went to work with the, we all had these things. And now I look back and I say, well, horrible and ridiculous and really egotistical of us, because I was thinking, gosh, how many patients did I put in danger going into work with the flu? I mean, that's terrible. We shouldn't do that. So we, and I think it's that badge of honor. Well, I'm, superhuman and I'm the best doctor because I worked through. No, we're actually only human beings doing the best we can. And we need to say to whoever, the administration or whomever, our senior, this is what I can do safely. And this is the limit. And somebody else is going to have to help out, and we're going to have to figure out another system. It's the only way that we're going to fix this system is if we say, enough is enough. This is broken. Patients are going to be harmed, and something has to change.
I think you're right. I think it's through COVID that I realized how ridiculous of a culture that is that we come to work sick and we expect our
Yes.
coworkers to do the same. And you're right. At the end of the day, we're human and it's okay to take a day and spend it in bed when you're not feeling good. And if you need to remember it a different way, don't put your patients at risk by coming to work with the flu.
Right. And I mean, ultimately, you want to do it because also, your colleagues are going to work harder if you're
Sure.
not there. So that's also part of the culture. But that goes to, why do we have a system that is so narrowly staffed that is to, hanging by a thread, that if any one link of the chain can't show up, the whole thing falls apart. That is the problem. We
That's
cannot
true
run
too.
a system bare bones and expect, and we should have learned that from COVID. But of course, here we are. I don't see my friends in hospitals and ERs feeling like things are any better. My experience as an outpatient doctor looking at hospital situation, it doesn't look so good from my standpoint. I'm really worried about it. And I think we've got to put pressure on our administrators and our leaders and our politicians to fix this, because the system is very broken.
I agree. I hope, if nothing else, we will start to come together as a profession, whether it be through unionization or just speaking up as a group of colleagues at one hospital and say, whatever X is, we are not doing X, but let's try Y. We're willing to do Y. And it's a healthy, version of getting the work done with something that's tolerable for us as physicians.
I love that, because I think, doctors are problem solvers. We come up with creative solutions all day, every day. So, I think going to an administration, coming together, number one, you've got to have solidarity. Coming by yourself is going to be tough. Talk to your colleagues, talk to your friends, and come up with some solutions and pitch some ideas, because we are the ones that really understand how to take care of patients. So our leaders need to hear from us. They need our solutions. And I think pitching not just problems and complaints, but solutions, I think that is absolutely the best way forward.
I think at the end of the day, that is the best way that we can work on physician wellness is putting up boundaries, coming up with solutions, and just trying to make it a better place for all of us. Otherwise, everybody we know is just going to walk away from medicine, and that is not a good answer.
No, because we're all patients. If we're not now, we will be. So it's not just for us today as, workers, but actually as patients now and in the future.
I agree. Any last words that you have for the audience as to try and, take care of themselves as an individual?
Yeah, just don't give up. And remember that there's always another way. There's always an option. I really hope that doctors find a way to stay in medicine. I know that so many of us are seeking ways out of clinical practice, and I get it. Believe me, I get it. But ultimately, are you really going to be happy because you put this time and this effort and, everything inside of you was to become a physician? So let's try to find a way that we can keep practicing, but on our own terms, whatever that may be. Maybe it's part-time work, maybe it's locums, maybe it's contract work, maybe it's opening a practice, whatever it is. And it makes me sad when I see good, talented, hardworking doctors just feel like, I'm just going to go and do something that has nothing to do with medicine because I'm so broken and the system has just damaged me so much. I think, stop, get some help. And, maybe there's another way that you can get back into the system. Talk to your colleagues, talk to other people ha who have come up with alternative, creative ways of practicing medicine. I say this because I know that one day I'm going to need you. And, our family members are going to need you. So we've got to find a way to support physicians and to help them stay in practice.
I love it. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I just think you're so wise, and I love every time you're on the show, I learn something.
Thanks so much, Tammy. I love talking with you.
Well, thanks. Well, everyone, I hope you've learned something today too, and I hope you'll all join us again next week for Grand Rounds.